Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for being here. Thanks for discussing today with us RFID security. I'm Carsten, outgoing PhD student at the University of Virginia, and this is Henrik, an incoming PhD at the Humboldt University here in Berlin. Both our research is on RFID security and partly privacy, both of which we want to discuss today with you. RFID, as I'm sure almost everybody is aware of, are these tiny computer chips that have all but one purpose: to identify or authenticate themselves. So they are a virtual name tag for people and things. They are very cheap since they don't require battery or any fancy electronics around them. It's just a tiny piece of silicon with an antenna printed or metal around it. RFID security has been very widely discussed, and I'm sure everybody has followed some of that discussion. We want to move to focus a little bit away from just security to security and privacy, because we think that there's a much wider field of discussion that should be had, and that is the privacy impact of this new technology on everybody's lives. So RFIDs are being used as an identifier for things, but also more and more for people through their passport, through their train ticket, through different forms of payment tokens. And those identifiers are machine readable. So each of us becomes a machine readable object in some virtual world. And unless cryptography, for instance, is used to prevent our text from being read by illegitimate readers, we are all beacons, but not like the Open Beacon Project, beacons where we voluntarily subscribe, but beacons that can be read out all the time. And so we find that the discussion hasn't quite moved beyond security yet, and we hope to kick this off with our work and with this talk. And where this discussion comes back to security is at the availability of good cryptography. Both for security and for privacy, you need cryptography as the underlying toolbox to protect data, and private data in particular. And we find that currently available RFID tokens do not, or the vast majority of them, does not have sufficient cryptography. Case in point is the MIFAC Classic RFID tag, which uses a proprietary cryptography. The manufacturer came up with that cryptography and kept it secret for many years. And now, almost exactly a year ago, it leaked or started to leak. And the subsequent analysis of it has shown that this is very weak. So just very briefly, how this works: this is a stream cipher. So there's a secret state, and both the reader and the card that want to communicate now know a secret key. So both of them have this mechanism, and they load the secret key into the secret state. And now, so that replay attacks are prevented — we'll get to that in a few minutes — so that replay attacks are prevented, random numbers have to be exchanged. That's a normal step in every cryptographic protocol. So a challenge and response random number is exchanged, one from the generated by the reader and one by the tech. And both of those are also seeded into the secret state. And the end of this authentication step, both sides should be convinced that that the other side knows the secret key and that they can now privately communicate with the other side. Now, this talk is mostly going to be about attacks generally on RFIDs and how they apply to MIFAC Classic, and how the assumptions that are underlying this mechanism are broken. In particular, that this state is secret. We show ways to reveal the state that should be secret. So we'll talk about various attacks, both the general form and how it applies to MIFAC Classic. We'll then briefly touch on possible mitigation steps that have been proposed. And we'll only discuss two in depth that we see some chance of success in. And we'll finally release a couple of tools to help you get started in RFID security research. to help you understand what we can attack, let me very briefly describe how exactly this authentication is happening between the card and the reader. So you see where we are interfering. The card starts off by sending its identifier and a random number to the reader. Nothing else. So far, it hasn't given out much private data. You could call this identifier private, but in most cases, it's not considered to be. The reader then needs to prove to the card that it knows the secret key. So it takes this random number that was generated by the card and encrypts it under the secret key, sends it back. Now, the card is convinced that the reader knows the secret key. The reader, in turn, has to be convinced that the card knows the secret key. It, too, sends a random number, and the tech will then encrypt the combination of these two random numbers and sends it back. Now, both sides are convinced that they can securely communicate. Now, what about this can we break? Well, pretty much everything. We can... if certain security precautions haven't... been taken in the design, we can break pretty much everything. We can emulate, that is, pretend to be somebody else, use somebody else's identification. We can perhaps predict random numbers or alter them in ways so that they become predictable and not random as they're supposed to be. We can attack the encryption itself and maybe reveal the secret key that's underlying that is supposed to be secret. And we can finally attack the radio waves and the radio channel and break the assumption that if there are two devices talking to each other, they must be physically close. Henrik, do you want to get into describing the first attack?
The first and simplest attack, or most simple attack, is a relay attack or a proxy attack, depending on who you ask. It consists simply of a device that emulates a reader and talks to the real card, and a device that emulates a card and talks to the real reader. Between these two, there must be some communication channel. Must not be radio. It doesn't have to be radio. It can be wired, or it can be radio. It can be pretty much anything. You can run this over GSM or whatever you want. So you have basically unlimited range, which breaks the assumption that this card is in close proximity to the reader when it's used. So, for example, if you have an RFID credit card and normally when you swipe it or have it in your hand, you're pretty sure that you have it in your hand, but if you only put something in front of the reader, that can really be a card emulator and somebody else. You need an accomplice or somebody who is in close proximity to the real card. And then that gets forwarded, and the real reader thinks it sees the real card, but it does not. Which is also useful, for example, if you want to gain access to buildings and don't have any other attack available to break the encryption or the authentication of the card. So the relay attack works almost always. There are certain distance bounding protocols, but nobody uses them. And most of them are kind of hard to implement because they are working based on the speed of light. So you get a pretty good guarantee by pure physics that the card must be within a range of about 30 meters or 300 meters of the reader. But in order to do that, you need to measure the signal, the travel time of the signal with nanosecond precision. And that gets messy in the hardware. Nobody implements that because it's too expensive.
Yeah. So here's an attack that really works against every RFID card that is commercially available. And I don't think any manufacturer currently is even preparing a product that would prevent this. So everything else left aside, this is always possible. Other attacks, and we'll go through... like. Other attacks, and I'll now always give you the general idea of the attack, and Henrik will explain how this applies to MIFAC Classic in particular, which is a nice target to play around with because it's vulnerable against so many different things. So emulation is based on the simple idea of pretending to be somebody else, sending somebody else's unique ID, which isn't possible from another RFID tag usually because the manufacturer go through great lengths, ensuring that every ID will ever only be manufactured once. But who's to say that you need to use an RFID tag to pretend to be another RFID tag? You can just use an emulation device, and we have a bunch of them floating around here. So little devices that are not even much bigger than the cards that they're emulating, and that you can easily hide in a wallet. They can pretend to be an RFID tag, and in particular pretend to be somebody else's RFID tag. And how does that play out with my fare?
Yeah, what we have here is an access control, a building access control system built by a great, big German manufacturer and sold to many universities and many other facilities. They actually have different types of these access control systems, and these devices have different security features, but usually the university just buys the cheapest one, which was the case in this case. And this device doesn't even use the encryption that we later broke, but it uses only the unique identifier of the card. And as you've seen, I can easily spoof that with one of my card emulators. And this video I recorded in January last year, where I didn't even have the full emulation working on the card emulator. It didn't work at all. It could only send, it could not receive. So I only sent out the UID basically at random, and it just worked with this access control system. No challenge response, no nothing.
Yeah, complete security disaster here, but it's only securing other keys. Another attack. So I said random numbers are really important and a fundamental step in every cryptographic protocol. That is because if two parties communicate, even encrypted, and there wasn't any randomness, they would always say the exact same thing to each other, encrypted, but nonetheless, you would prove that you're in the possession of a secret key simply by replaying what you overheard somebody else saying. So there must be random numbers. Now, on RFIDs, it's kind of hard to generate randomness. They're tiny computer chips, and how in a computer program do you get random numbers? In Linux, you would collect polling events, you would do timing, you would use the fact that your computer is an incredibly complex system and the user operating it is even more complex, and so the multitude of inputs then gives you enough data to generate randomness based on. In RFID tags, you don't have anything like that, and you don't have sophisticated RF measurement equipment either to maybe get randomness from the airwaves. So this has been a long-standing problem, and at least when the MIFA Classic chip was designed, this hadn't been sufficiently solved yet.
Yeah, and the MIFA Classic chip is really well documented. The random number generator that we found in there in our reverse engineering attempts, you basically wouldn't even need to reverse engineer the MIFA Classic card to find the MIFA Classic random number generator, which is pictured down here. There are two problems. There's only one problem. It's not a real random number generator. It's a linear feedback shift register, so it's a pseudo random number generator, which is quite often the case, but it's also seeded from a fixed start value. They initialize it with 10, 10, 10, and so on. And it's initialized when the card is powered up, so when you put the card into the field, it gets power, it powers up, initiates the reset sequence, and then the random number generator is reset to 10, 10, 10, and then shifts with this simple to determine sequence at 106 kilohertz, that's the ISO bit clock. So it starts in a fixed state and clocks with a fixed shift register feedback at a fixed frequency, and it's completely predictable in the MIFA Classic cards. So, and the random number is used when you start the authentication procedure. As we said before, you need the random number only in the authentication procedure. And if you control the timing between powering up the card and starting the authentication procedure, you completely control the random number that gets generated and can reliably regenerate the same random number each time.
Yeah, and this is a very easy attack vector. If you have some proprietary RFID system, this is probably the first you should try out. And you might even find it accidentally. Do you want to tell them how we first read the MIFA some 20 times, and then how often do we get the exact same number?
I was sniffing data, and the sniffing setup was kind of convoluted because I used a logic analyzer which had some Windows software, so I had a VMware running that had the Windows software for the logic analyzer, and then I had my Linux machine which ran the decoding software that would analyze the logic analyzer output, and I needed to copy data from the VMware into my Linux machine to run the decoder. And to get samples, I simply used an OpenPCD and had a power switch in the power line of the OpenPCD. And to get a new sample, I just switched the OpenPCD off and on. So it would start new, it would generate a new field, and the card would be initialized, and the OpenPCD would authenticate to the card right away at almost always the same time. And then I captured that in my logic analyzer and analyzed that, and the first two attempts were the same. I got the same random number. I was kind of confused because that is not supposed to happen. That's a random number. Maybe I copied the same file twice or did something wrong by copying from the VMware to the Linux machine. So I tried that again and got the same number again, but with a different part after that. So there was a different random number from the reader, but the same random number from the card. So obviously it was not the same file, but still the same random number from the card. And then I did like 23 trials of that in half an hour. And out of these 23, I got 12 times the same random number from the card and 6 times the same random number from the reader. So in total, I had 6 completely identical traces from 23 trials without doing anything special on the reader. I just had a reader that would authenticate right away after being switched on. And because it's a reader, it's in firmware, it doesn't have any timing problems, it would generate the same timing most of the time by accident.
Very much reminded us of this random number generator, what we saw there. Okay, moving on. Another set of attacks, and these are now the really interesting ones, the ones that break cryptographic assumptions. And we'll only go over those that apply generally. That is not just to MIFAC Classic. There's a bunch of things you can do to just break the crypto one. It's kind of boring since it's already broken. And so these are things you can always do. The idea of a cryptographic break is to reverse a function that is supposed to be one way. So any encryption function, hash function, what have you in your cryptographic toolkit is a function that you should be with ease be able to compute in one direction given the secret key, but never in the other direction, at least not unless you have a secret key. Now, and we are breaking this assumption, and there's many ways to break this. And as I said, I'll go over them generally, and then Henrik adds what you can do to MIFAC Classic. The first and easiest and most obvious is to try all possible keys. One will fit. And in the analogy of a normal key that you use to open your door, the key is there are more keys as the shape of the key gets more complex. So imagine one of these American normal house keys. They usually only have 5 T's, and say these 5 T's could only either be high or low. So there's 32 possibilities of what the key could look like. And the easiest to get into the door is to have 32 different keys. Try them all. One will fit. Now, computers are a lot faster at trying keys. They can try a few billion keys a second, depending on the crypto algorithm. But all the keys that they use also have a lot more T's, or bits in this case. And the more bits you have, the harder it becomes to try out all possible keys. And so that is why the bit lengths should be at least a certain minimum. And in symmetric ciphers today, we're talking about 80 bits minimum for internet-grade security. Now, if a classic card uses, for instance, 48-bit keys, that's clearly below that threshold. But depending on the application, you could say anything up to 64 bits is weak and breakable in some way if the incentives or the stakes are high enough for somebody to attempt to break the key and has sufficient hardware resources.
Yeah, the MIFAC Classic has 48 bits, as we've already said, which is really weak. You can imagine PDF encryption was usually 40 bits, and you would break that on your home PC in a weekend. 48 is not that much more. The brute force key search on the protocol works only if you know the protocol. If you don't know the protocol, you need to do a brute force attack on the card, which would take kind of longer because the card is kind of slow and only gets one attempt every 6 milliseconds, I think. So if you would try all possible keys against one card, you'd take 50,000 years, something like that. But if you know the algorithm, you can just implement the algorithm on your own computer, which can be as fast as you want, or you can implement it on FPGA, which can be even faster. And you can build an FPGA that cracks the key, or somebody has built an FPGA that cracks the key in 50 minutes for a couple of thousand dollars, I think. So that's quite fast already with specialized hardware.
Yeah, if I may add to that, so one of the features of this card that we probably broke was the security through obscurity. If your only access to the system is through the defined API, through asking the card to please verify whether what you computed is correct, you indeed need 200,000 years to break a single key. Once you know the algorithm and can implement it on your own hardware, that number goes down to 50 minutes. So please do never rely on obscurity in your security design, and do never assume that even though you never told anybody your algorithm, nobody knows it. They can find it, and we found this one, for instance, through reverse engineering the chip itself, and clearly you have to give the chip to your customers. That's how you make money. Moving on, other cryptographic attacks that apply generally. There's this whole field of time-memory trade-offs, and the idea here is to compute a code book. Now, think of this one-way function as a secret language. So every word that you can come up with, every bit string, has an equivalent in the other language. And only you and whomever you communicate with speaks that language. So the encryption would be to translate it from your language into that secret language. Now, one way to break it would be a dictionary. If somebody had a dictionary the reverse way, the secret language into your language, that would be the decryption. Now, building such a dictionary is usually impossible because there's so many different words. Again, the number of bits in the key determines how large the dictionary is. And if there's 48 bits in the key, then there's 2 to the 48 possible bit strings or entries in your dictionary. But there's points in between the two extremes of building the entire dictionary and trying every key one by one. So you can compute parts of the dictionary, or even the entire dictionary, but not store it, but store it rather compressed. So the technique that is used is called rainbow tables. And in those rainbow tables, put the most simple way, you just write down the first and the last word of every dictionary page. But since the dictionary is structured in a certain way, if you find the first, or rather the last word of the page, you can compute the entire page again very quickly and then find the word in the middle that you were looking for. And there are trade-offs. They are somewhere trading off more pre-computation time. That always goes in as a variable. But then in the actual attack, trade-off time and space. So the more space resources, meaning hard disk, you throw at the problem, the quicker you can break keys. And 48-bit is very doable for time-memory trade-offs. In fact, almost easy. They've been breaking 64-bit keys with ease now with time-memory trade-offs. And the GSM cracking project that unfortunately came to an almost complete stop now, they have pre-computed exactly these compressed code books to break GSM communication, 64-bit keys. So for the MIFAC classic case, 48-bit key, do you have the numbers, roughly?
I think it was like a couple of terabytes, which is really affordable in space, will get you a full break on a normal PC, not FPGA, no special hardware, except the hard disks, in an hour or so.
So for a few hundred dollars or euros in hardware resources, meaning hard disks, you get an attack platform that breaks you single keys in seconds, or definitely under a minute. And this, let me stress that, works on every 48-bit cipher. It didn't yet attack anything special about this cipher, any weakness. So the the sheer fact that the key is too short allows for this, and also allows for the brute force attacks. So whenever you find a crypto system that uses a key anything below 64 bits, you can do this attack. More advanced attacks. And these are really fun. This is almost cutting-edge research. So this is a new idea almost. I said your goal is to reverse a one-way function. Now, you can do this by writing out a code book. You can do this by trying out every possibility and seeing which one matches. Or you can simply try to do it mathematically. If a function can be computed in one direction, maybe there's a way to compute it the other way. And unless you're a super genius mathematician, you probably want to rely on the knowledge of other mathematicians. And mathematicians have created what they call the set solvers, satisfiability solvers, over many years now, and have been really perfected to do to reverse functions or to solve problems that we know have a solution, we just don't know what the solution is. And the most prize-winning ones, these are some of the trophies, is Miniset and Mathé Sauce from INRIA. He was just ingenious in using Miniset and to porting it so that Miniset now can be used to break crypto problems. So all you do to reverse a cipher now is describe the cipher mathematically, in mathematical terms, in equations. That's fairly straightforward. The next slide will illustrate that. And then give this one instance of the problem, meaning you know what went in and you know what came out, you just don't know the secret key. Give this instance of the problem to the satisfiability solver, and it will find the one key that makes the equations work out. Right? Really, that's straightforward. And just to show you how straightforward this has become, let's just for fun run one instance here of the MyFair cracker.
So this is an application of the satisfiability problem that you probably learned about in theoretical computer science if you're studying computer science at the university and always wondered, why am I doing this? Why am I being told about a satisfiability problem? What's that good for?
So this is what's good for. This is now going through a stage that we call guess and determine. What we do is we guess a few of the key bits, say 6 bits. So there's only, no, in this case, I think it's, yeah, 6 bits. So there's 64 possibilities of what these 6 bits could be, and only one is right. So we give it 63 guesses that are wrong, and it will tell us it's unsatisfiable. And one of the guesses will be correct, so the remaining key bits will work out. And this is now running on my slow Mac on battery, but it shouldn't take more than like 40 or 45 seconds to reverse this entire cipher and give us all the remaining key bits.
Yeah, this is running on a sniffed test example with a key, with the standard key of FFFFFF,
exactly.
And so on.
So the last bytes that came out of here is the secret key. We just reversed from an overheard sniff of MyFair communication. We broke the secret key by throwing this problem at a mathematical tool. Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what exactly did we do? Well, we described the function, and now I'm showing just the filter function, the binary table that maps the secret state into what we observe, the output bits. It's simple binary equations. Each of these can be seen as a lookup table, a 4-to-1 and then a 5-to-1 lookup table. So we write out these lookup tables, or rather the binary equations behind them. We take 50-some instances, meaning output bits. For each of those, we write out the filter function. And the one last step is then to compute from those 50-some different secret states are a linear function of each other because it's a linear feedback shift register. Some of you might know what that is. And so we arrive at a few hundred equations, short equations, and those are enough given to the SET solver to break this crypto problem. So this is no rocket science and could probably be done with pretty much any low complexity cipher. So now we're really attacking the nature of this beast. We're not attacking the key size anymore. We're not attacking the protocol, the bad random numbers. Here we are attacking statistical weaknesses, things that cryptographers would probably have found if this had been analyzed by cryptographers before, and weaknesses that you'd want to avoid. For those of you that know a little bit more of cryptography, what we're really exploiting here is the lack of non-linearity, mostly, that complexity doesn't add up over many rounds, but that everything is connected through XOR, which is a linear function. Okay, moving on. To sum up the MIFAR weaknesses, this is not an example of a system where a little thing went wrong and now it's exploitable and needs a patch. This is an example of a system where pretty much every building block is fundamentally flawed. So this entire system consists of broken building blocks, and the different attacks are enabled by either single broken building blocks or the interaction of different ones. But this is probably a great example to study and to try out attacks, and a very warning example for anybody who attempts to do cryptography themselves. So here's a summary of things that you can do wrong if you try to do cryptography. MIFAR, however, is not a lone example and a one-time mistake in an industry that would otherwise come up with good products. Pretty much any RFID card that claims to be secure, with the exception of very recent ones, uses proprietary and uses weak encryption. And this is really a summary of the entire market. Newer installations, the ones that are maybe 2 or 3 years old, they might already be using standard ciphers. AES, NXP calls that the Death Fire card, for instance. Logic has some 13 megahertz cards that do AES. HID has some newer cards. But pretty much any installation that you'll find out there so far that uses secure RFID is breakable, and probably breakable with the very techniques I've just listed. So there's a lot more work to do, and if you are an active user of any of these systems, be aware of that. And if you're an active hacker with too much time, please help us attack some more of these.
Yeah, and it's not really true that most new installations are using secure systems, because these usually are slightly more expensive, and if you show that to a bureaucrat who says, but it says secure on both of them, so we take the less expensive one, they'll usually use MIFAR Classic or the Logic Old or the HID Old system. Or they have a systems integrator who doesn't know squat about anything and uses the old cards and doesn't have the new cards. So, for example, my university is building a new building and they are using the only two options they said would be UID, serial number based, or MIFAR Classic cryptography. Death Fire was never an option.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So. Yeah, there are some proposed mitigations for short-term efforts, for not for long-time replacements, but for short-time mitigation until you're ready to roll out the new system. Some vendors are already offering this, for example, under the name of Digitale Signatur, or Digital Signature, which isn't really necessary. What they basically do is check the UID, because those two systems fall into two classes: those that only check the UID and those that use the cryptography but don't care about the UID at all. So now they have a new idea: let's use the cryptography and the UID. And the way they do that is not by checking the UID in the backend system, because that would be much more complicated, but they simply put the UID onto the card and digitally sign it with some key. So that if you modify the card contents or simply copy the card onto your new card, which was an attack that was very viable previously. For example, the Dutch demonstrated that on their university system, and then the Dutch Minister of the Interior kind of noticed that they are using the same system and put up armed guards on all entrances. So for these systems, it's a short-time mitigation technology to sign the UID or any other data that you are putting on the card and not rely on the MIFAR classic access control mechanism. So you don't rely on that, that it wouldn't be writable, but just assume that it's writable and then sign it and check the signature for all valid state. And there's another technology that might be possible, maybe somewhat more complicated. I think there was a talk on day one about it on fingerprinting, where you try to detect certain characteristics on the radio frequency spectrum and try to detect emulators. As we said, the UID can be spoofed if you're emulating the card and not copying simply the content onto a new card. So if you're doing RF fingerprinting, you might be able to detect that there is an emulator in place and then can decline the card. Or if they don't have an emulator, they most likely have the wrong UID, so you can detect that too.
Yeah. So the idea here is to use external cryptography that the card doesn't really understand, but that where it only has to store the data to sign data and make sure that every state that is... that a state that a card claims it has at the moment existed at some point in time. If you then also can tie it to the card itself, the only attack vector would be to use an emulator, in which case you want to do radio fingerprinting to perhaps detect everything other than RFID cards. So these are both techniques that don't work 100% and that are probably circumventable, but from our experience of building emulators, it's really hard to get them exactly 100% right. And if you just implemented these, you're one step ahead of the hackers, and you bought yourself a little extra time to replace MIFAR with something else, but you don't get around doing that. You might just have some more time. Knowing that people want to migrate away from MIFAR Classic, we've been looking around for possible platforms to use to build, say, the next generation RFID system from. And we've been shocked to see that most systems tie an RFID reader IC to the cards. So every time your cards get compromised, you also throw away your reader infrastructure and basically start from scratch. We thought this was an untakeable state, and so we went about implementing one of the first, perhaps the first, mostly software-driven RFID reader, where we implement MIFAR Classic as a software module on this RFID reader by Texas Instruments. Since MIFAR Classic is just a software component in here, if you want to replace your MIFAR Classic card with something else, you just flash these devices, and you could probably, if you designed your reader based on these ICs, do this wirelessly or through the reader network. So here's an idea that we hope will catch on in the industry to build RFID readers more software-based and to make them more flexible so you can quicker react to security breaches. Because as I've shown, MIFAR Classic is not the only weak card. And even the cards that we today think are at least cryptographically strong, those will come up with their own problems, and they'll need to be replaced at some point. Another nice application of this reader, since everything is in software, you can change tiny bits, and you can make it behave slightly wrong, which I guess software people call fuzz testing. Hasn't been done much in RFID yet, but say you wanted to fuzz test your NFC phone, this would be the reader to do it with, to start changing things, maybe send an extra bit where it doesn't belong and see how the phone behaves. These implementations, these software stacks, are full of bugs, I'm sure. The software we're using on this has been posted to my website yesterday, so feel free to download that, play around with it. It has a full MIFAR Classic implementation in it, and we are selling these devices for €50 downstairs at the FIRBU, where all the T-shirts hang. And we will have a workshop tomorrow to help you all get started with these. So buy one today or tomorrow morning. Come to a workshop. This will be 12:45 in the workshop area. And we'll show you what software you need, how to compile the source code, and how to maybe start building your own RFID fast tester. Yeah, so that's the first tool we're releasing. Thanks.
Yeah, the second tool is the OpenPICC, which we have already talked about a lot in the last years. And it was originally designed as an RFID emulator that should be able to emulate any RFID card in the 13.456 megahertz range. Unfortunately, I didn't get it to work. As we said, the timing of RFID emulators is kind of hard, and until now, I've worked on it mostly the most part of the last year, and I didn't get it to work properly so that it works reliable. It works like 80% of the time, but that's not exactly good enough for most attacks. So that's not so nice. But what I did get working is to do a full duplex RFID sniffing on that. That's kind of a side effect, an unwanted side effect, because normally when you build an RFID emulator, you only want to receive the RFID reader signal. And what we found is that if you put a card, another RFID card, like really close to that, like so, I have double-sided sticky tape on here below that, so I hope it sticks. Really close to that, you'll also receive the signal that the other card sends. And then I implemented firmware that simply receives the signal and sends it through USB, which sounds simpler than it is, and is received by a host application on the PC, and I basically get a radio receiver for 13.56 megahertz that can do amplitude demodulation and sample the demodulated signal at 3.3 megasamples per second, binary signal. And if you set the threshold value just right and choose the distance between the card and sniffer and the reader just right, it's slightly complicated now. Still, I'm going to make that easier. If you choose the distance just right, you receive the signal both of the reader device and of the card, and you have a full duplex sniffer for not a lot of money. Unfortunately, we don't have much of these left. I think we have about two of these left, which we need for our own purposes, but we're going to build new ones, and they will be released in January about, probably.
And if you already have one, here's the URL to download the most recent firmware.
Yeah, that's not yet in there, the sniffing for both directions. That's only the code for sniffing in one direction, but I'll add the code for sniffing both directions shortly. And what you will get is, as I said, amplitude demodulation, transmission of the signal to the host. On the host, there's an application running that's decoding and demangling the samples, and you get an output that basically has all zeros and ones for all the samples, and you get an output that has all the changes in the signal, and then you get an application that uses these deltas times to decode the protocols and probably decode ISO 14443A, so you get a full duplex ISO 14443A dump that you then can use with the other tool, the algebraic crack tool, to break MIFA encryption, for example. I already did that yesterday for somebody. So if you have a card and a reader, that's the problem. If you have a card and a reader with you, you can just find me, and I will break your key for you. My yeah. DECT phone is 5015.
For those that didn't get that now, if you are the legitimate owner of a MIFA card that you lost the key to, this is the device that gets you the data out of your card again. So that was the open pick that has been sold out in the web shop a long time ago, and that is now being reproduced, but Milos and Britta Meriab, the sleepless ingenious hardware designers, they have come up with the OpenPIC 2, which just blows me away. But let Henrik tell you about it.
Yeah, the OpenPSDC2 is a dual multi-purpose device. It's kind of like a multi-application card, if you know that term from smart card vendors. What you get on there? You have a processor, an RT91 processor with 48 megahertz frequency. You get 16 megabytes of SD RAM. You get an SD card slot in the back. Let me show that here. That's the processor. That's the SD RAM. A micro SD card slot. Then you have the new processor is much easier to flash than the previous one. If you know how to flash OpenPSDC 1, the OpenPSDC 2 is so much easier. You just press this button and send the new firmware. You get the two LEDs that you know and love. You get a third LED that is connected to the battery charge controller, so you get a full lithium-ion battery. I haven't tested yet how long it will last, but I accidentally left my device on for like 3 hours, and it wasn't discharged after 3 hours, so I guess it will last 3 hours, depending on what you do with it. What you get on there also is a three-dimensional accelerometer. So, for example, you could, let's say, booby trap the device so it would lead itself if it's tampered with or something, if you want to. And the RFID, you also get a real-time clock that is, I think, about here, which is always connected to the battery and not switched on or off. So you have also a clock on there. You will get an open beacon interface. Yeah,
that's Sputnik, the things that people carry around. It can talk to that too.
It's the same 2.4 GHz transmission interface. So if you have two of these devices, you could let them talk to each other. And which I hadn't mentioned just yet, the RFID part on this is handled by the NXP chip, the NXP PN532, which is an NFC chip, which is included in most, well, in some phones and hopefully much more in the future. So it does NFC, which also means it does a reader side, complete reader side, and it does a complete card side emulation in this one IC. So it doesn't have the full analog front end that Milos designed for the OpenPSDC 1, which enabled us to sniff the communication. Unfortunately, it's not in there. The filters in this device are much better, unfortunately, so it won't be a sniffer, probably. Sorry about that. But it should be a full emulator because we don't have to worry about the analog side anymore. We just get a proper signal. What we did, what this NFC chip does offer, is the connection of a so-called secure element, which is just a wired NFC, NXP card, SmartMX, for example. So you normally just hardwire an RFID card to that, and instead of that, we just connected these wires to the processor, so we should be able to emulate a card on the processor.
Yeah, so here's a card that can talk to pretty much anything RFID, both the readers and the cards and the Sputniks, that has enough power under the hood to do simple crypto.
We are not done yet.
Oh, there's more. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, because it does have this 2.4 GHz interface. If you have two of these, you should be able to execute the proxying or relay attack with that, because you can set one for card emulation and one for reader side emulation and have a 2.4 GHz radio link. And you have this battery with charge controller. And also there's, well, this thing is two things in one. It's a micro SD slot, and it's also an ID000 smart card interface, so you can put in a real wired smart card and store your secrets in there so that somebody who finds that doesn't get your secrets. And,
Yeah, so we do crypto on board here if we want to, at least low complexity ciphers. We were talking about rainbow tables. I don't know what size they make SD cards in these days, but there should be plenty of storage for at least like the Dutch group released a tool, Crypto One. That should run on this device, I think, to onboard break MyFair Classic encryption. It's portable too with a battery. It's just ingenious. There's one more thing. Do you want to add something?
Yeah, and one more thing.
It's an ebook reader too.
Can
no
I have
kidding.
A camera on here? camera. It's an e-book reader, yeah.
This goes to Britton and Miloš Meria. This will be available in numbers in February, I hear. So keep tuned.
Yeah, I think Miloš, if you'd want to talk to Miloš, I think he's looking for open source developers because all the firmware that is currently running on this device is open source at our SourceForge repository. And I think he will be looking for open source developers also for the ebook branch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so definitely a device to be looking forward to. To quickly sum up, if you are building RFID systems, please make sure you use documented standard ciphers that a lot of cryptanalysis has gone into, and implement as much as possible, if not everything, in software, so that if the nasty hacker comes up with the next exploit, you can quickly react and you can quickly upgrade your infrastructure. If you are more like us and you like to play around with things, start doing that, get our tools, get the TI board, join our workshop tomorrow, wait impatiently for the OpenPIC to be available as a sniffer, the OpenPIC 2 as a full-blown emulator, ebook, what have you, and help us develop the software for all these devices. There's a lot of developing effort going in by Henrik, Miloš as well, and we need more people to get things moving quicker. There's so many RFID systems we'd like to be looking at. To end at a more positive note, so we haven't given up hope in this technology yet, and we think it has huge potential to be a great breakthrough, more security technology, if a few things are done right. As said over and over again, use public crypto, don't try to build your own, but also don't be paranoid about attackers. Be more aware of what the risks are and how much damage can really be caused. Oftentimes, hope is given up at the mere sight of some possibility of an attack where huge attack vectors are completely ignored. So we need some more balance, some more what we would call threat modeling, a more holistic view of how vulnerable is your RFID system and what risk are you willing to take. And then from my consulting work, I've come across over and over again of the one number one enemy of RFID system, and that is vandalists. Most of these systems are today pressed onto people. You don't get a choice whether you have an RFID in your passport, in your train ticket, and so forth anymore. This is your number one enemy, people that break your system simply because you force them to use the technology. So by only giving them an opt-out opportunity, by giving them a chance not to use the technology, your system is already a lot more secure. There's a lot less incentive to break it. So if you are operating an RFID system planning on, if you're consulting with anybody who is planning to, please press for an opt-out so that this technology isn't mandatory for everyone. Thanks a lot.
Okay, so now we would be open to questions. I think we have about 6 minutes left for our assigned time, and then maybe some more.
Yeah, and I kindly ask you to stay here for a few minutes until we're done. So if you've got to leave quietly so that there's not a huge disruption. Anyways, questions?
That's weird.
Did we lose everybody, or were we perfectly clear about every single point? No questions? Okay, well, thanks a lot, everybody.